Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, the chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. This evening, you'll be listening to Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, 2009 Nobel laureate, discuss her life in science in conversation with UCSF Chancellor Susan Desmond-Hellman, the former president of product development at Genentech. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers, Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn and Chancellor Susan Desmond-Hellman. Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, PhD, is the recipient of the 2009 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for her discoveries in telomere biology that have uncovered a new understanding of normal cell functioning and given rise to a growing field of inquiry. Dr. Blackburn earned a PhD in molecular biology at the University of Cambridge. In 1975, she moved to the United States and attended Yale University for a postdoctoral fellowship in the laboratory of Joseph Gall. There, she began what would become her groundbreaking work on the ciliate, tetrathymina, thermophila, sequencing the ends of chromosomes and uncovering strange DNA repeats. She discovered that telomere DNA was being replenished by an unknown mechanism and predicted that it involved an enzyme, a contrary notion at that time. Later in 1984, while working as an associate professor at the University of California, Berkeley, she and her graduate student, Carol Grader, identified telomerase and later showed that this protein is composed of both a protein and an RNA component, with the RNA serving as the template to add DNA telomerase. Dr. Blackburn quickly rose to full professorship at UC Berkeley before becoming the chair of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at UCSF, where she and her team are advancing the leading edge of telomere biology. Dr. Blackburn is currently the Morris Hanstein Endowed Chair in Biology and Physiology in the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics at UCSF. She is also a non-resident fellow of the Salk Institute. Dr. Susan Desmond-Hellman, MD, MTH, is Chancellor of University of California, San Francisco. She is also an Arthur and Tony Rembrock Distinguished Professor. Prior to joining UCSF in August 2009, Chancellor Desmond-Hellman was President of Product Development at Genentech. During her time in Genentech, several of the company's patient therapeutics were approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and the company became the nation's number one producer of anti-cancer drug treatments. In November 2009, Forbes magazine named Chancellor Desmond Hellmann as one of the world's 7 most powerful innovators, calling her a hero in the legions of cancer patients. These 7 powerful innovators were praised for their curiosity, empathy, and leadership. Chancellor Desmond Hellmann completed her clinical training at UCSF and is board certified in internal medicine and medical oncology. She holds a Bachelor of Science degree in pre-medicine and a medical degree from the University of Nevada, Reno, and a master's degree in public health from the University of California, Berkeley. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn and Chancellor Susan Desmond Hellmann.
Thank you. Thank you for that very nice introduction.
Thank you.
Here's what Liz and I hope to do this evening. I'm going to play Oprah. I'm going to ask the questions. There'll be no crying involved, though. At least I don't think any crying until you ask your questions, I guess. And I'm going to interview Liz, and I'm going to interview her and try and ask some of the questions that I hope might be on your minds, and maybe not. We're going to stop at around 20 till 7 and open up for questions, so you'll have a chance to think of your own questions while we're talking. And let me start out by asking Liz, what's a telomere anyway? Help people understand the science behind the discovery, and particularly the in all the world's things of how you could be picked to win the Nobel Prize, the discovery of telomeres and telomerase, what was the importance to the world of your discovery with your colleagues?
Well, your first question, what is a telomere? We have to think back to our cells, and every cell has genetic information in it, all our genes, and our genes are on chromosomes, tiny little linear bodies. And so the genes are arrayed along the chromosomes, which are linear, and they have ends. And it turns out the ends have to be protected very, very thoroughly by the cell for all sorts of complex, interesting reasons. But the ends of the chromosomes have to be protected. They're vulnerable. And what's fascinating about them is that they wear down as cells keep replenishing themselves. And so if you think about that, then you might ask the next question, which is, well, why are we here anyway? Because wouldn't they have all worn down a long time ago? And the answer turns out to be that the enzyme that was alluded to earlier, we have a way within our cells consisting of a special, very interesting enzyme. We called it telomerase. We actually got to add a word to the Webster's Dictionary. It's now in the dictionary, and my proudest accomplishment. And so this enzyme has the job of replenishing back the worn-down ends of the chromosomes. It builds them back up. So you'd think, this is fine. The cell's got it all figured out. Everything is good. Now we get to people. And so we have this nasty habit of living many, many, many decades, right? It's nice for us, but over time our telomeres would be wearing down. So you'd think, well, perhaps we'd have enough telomerase to keep it going long enough such that they never wear down. But the trouble is, they do kind of wear down sometimes faster than telomerase can keep replenishing the backup. And so this wasn't clear for quite a long time, you know, how was this going to relate to people? But it turns out that if you look at how much the telomeres in our cells wear down, and you can use typical cells that, like, you get from a blood draw, you can, you know, ask this question, you find that that relates to a lot of the very common diseases that happen as we're aging, like cardiovascular disease and even now risk for cancer. It seems like as things wear down, the genetic information gets less protected, cells can't replenish properly. And how that plays out is turning out to have real relationship to whether diseases, common diseases of old age, will develop. So that's what we see. We see these things going hand in hand. And so interesting questions have emerged. Can you change it? You know, there is telomerase in in the cells that really do the replenishing, and those are called the stem cells, which are very famous for other reasons. But we have stem cells through many of our tissues that will try to keep things replenishing. But they do need enough telomere maintenance to do that. And so we are very fascinated to see just exactly how much of what we know is the wear and tear of our stem cells and our tissues replenishing throughout life. How much of this really is attributable to telomerase maintaining telomeres not being quite fast enough? Long answer to your question, but I hope
So you mentioned we'll clarify that it. Telomerase and telomeres are potentially very important in cancer and heart disease.
One maybe too much and one maybe too little? Yes, but you know what's so interesting about cancer? The normal cells, they also have to preserve their genetic material in order not to become cancerous. And so it turns out that the right amount of telomerase in the right good cells is helpful.
So not too much and not too little.
That's what we've learned, and we've learned it from genetic rare cases, where if these are fortunately rare, but sometimes there's an accident where somebody's genes don't give them enough telomerase. They don't have zero, but they don't have quite enough. And that's enough to make them cancer prone. And it's now clear from now dozens of families around the world. Luckily, it's rare, but it's very informative.
So Liz, can you also say something about telomeres and telomerase and stress? That's one of the areas where you've collaborated with other investigators at UCSF.
And so this was a wonderful UCSF story because about, I think it's approaching 10 years ago, a young scientist, PhD in clinical psychology, health psychology, came to me. Her name's Alyssa Eppel, and she's now an associate professor in the psychiatry department. She said, what happens to people's telomeres when they're under really chronic, bad stress, life stress? And I said, I don't know, but let's ask, right? And so she built a very careful series of clinical studies, and we're doing more and more with more and more people. But the bottom line was that we were able to see that stress of the kind that I can describe more, but think of it as long and chronic and bad, and not the good stress we do because we run a marathon and have a big challenge, but life events that can really, really make life very, very oppressive for people in bad ways, which have been long known actually to have effects on cardiovascular disease risk. And we found that this is wearing down the telomeres and gave the chronic stress effects a kind of material, sort of concrete feeling to what might be going on as to why chronic stress is having its effects on diseases, which, you know, are serious and common diseases. So we continue to study more and more of this with more and more different groups. But it was a real UCSF story because, you know, we're very different fields. And we had to sit and have lots of conversations so we could learn to talk each other's language.
So let me switch gears a little bit. The series that the Commonwealth Club is having is about women. And women, one of our colleagues at UCSF called 2009 the year of the woman at UCSF, our first woman chancellor and our first woman Nobel Prize winner. So I know there's many people in the audience who are interested, as I am, to think, gosh, you're the fourth Nobel Prize winner at UCSF and the first woman Nobel Prize winner at UCSF. When did you know that you would be a scientist? How soon during your life? When in school or when during, you know, were you a little baby walking around with test tubes? When did you know science was your thing?
Well, you know, I knew animals and nature was my thing pretty early. I love that. I think around middle school, I started to realize that science was something that I liked a lot. And then I think around high school, kind of put the two together and started thinking, I really like, you know, I liked animals. It was very straightforward, but I really wanted to understand them and then started understanding that there were things like cells and molecules and started to think, aha, that would be the real way to understand how living things, especially animals, how it really works. So it was something that had various stages in school, but I guess high school was the time when I realized, yes, that I'd like to be a scientist.
And how about mentorship? Did you have one or two particular people who were valuable to you as mentors and teachers during your path in science?
Yeah, I was very I was clueless about the idea that mentoring would be good, and so I certainly wasn't smart enough to think about seeking out mentors, which I think is different from young women now who are realizing it's important. But I was fortunate. There were a few people, and I can think of one, a math teacher, who sort of showed me that, yeah, I actually was better at math than I thought. And this was in high school. And also said, I know people who are interested in biochemistry, if you want to talk with them or something like that. So really very much encouraging me. That was my last year in high school. But earlier I'd had teachers who had been, they'd made science fun. And by being people who just were not,
Dull,
or yeah, they're trying to look for that that nice word. yes. And you know, when you're a kid, that sort of thing matters to you. Yeah. They weren't sports teachers as well. Sometimes I know sports and high school, chemistry teachers would often be one and the same
the
person.
Coach.
Yes, would be the coach. No, they weren't that. And I was in a women's school, and I think that helped somewhat. Mm. Although we did have a culture in our school that, to be too academic wasn't what was really approved of enormously, but I wasn't discouraged either, and I think the teachers were quite encouraging of me. So I feel very fortunate. I was because of the era I was doing this in, where it wasn't very common for women to be thinking about science, I think I was reasonably protected in the sense that subtly people were giving me encouragement.
That's great.
Yeah.
And when you were doing your research, I know that your research was carried out at UC Berkeley with Carol Greider and then moving over to UCSF.
Yes.
Was there a point in time, particularly in the early days when you were working with Carol Greider, was there a eureka moment? Was there something where the big light bulb was up above your head, like one moment when you said, aha,
yes,
our hypothesis is true, something very, very important. Can you describe to everybody the most eureka moment, or did it come in series of steps? What was that like?
Well, there were a couple of them, and they were somewhat alike, and they had to do with, we would use trace amounts of radioactivity to detect the biochemical molecular reactions, and then you detect the radioactivity by, of all things, putting an X-ray film down on some, spread out group of molecules. And what you look for is if something is happening, if an enzyme is working, over time it'll make more and more of whatever it makes. And one moment was very early, and Carol hadn't joined the lab yet, but I'd got this very early thing where I could see this particular kind of molecule increasing more and more over time. And I said, aha, something is there. It was in this huge, if you will, like bathtub mixture full of all sorts of junk, right? But I could see it there. And then Carol joined my lab, and she came as a PhD student. And she was adventurous enough to say, oh, this sounds like an interesting project. And I always like to point out my very experienced, very, wonderful postdoc. I'd offered him this project, and he said, well, thanks, Liz. No, I don't think I'll do that one. Right. But she was prepared to take this on.
Take the risk.
Mm-hmm. And then by using a much better method to spread the molecules out in a way where we could really see what DNA was being made, she then got a really beautiful, again, same thing, radioactive tracer images on an X-ray film, again, that really spread it out, and we said, okay, this really is what we were looking for. So both of them were very visual moments.
You could see something,
although it's a very abstract thing because you're looking at molecules spread out and you're just deducing from the patterns what really was going on.
That's great. That's terrific. So now one of the things that I think
we had a eureka moment for the stress too.
Oh, you did?
Tell me the eureka moment about stress.
Well,
this is numbers. But we'd done all these assays, and you have to do... I'll just tell you the story because it was a really interesting study. The women we were studying were chronically ill, children who were chronically ill, and it's the mother. And it was her child, and she's been taking care of this child for sometimes up to years and years and years. And we knew the number of years, we knew how intensely she was feeling this and perceiving it. And And so it was a really nicely designed study with controls. And so we were analyzing the telomere maintenance. How well was it working in their cells? Now, to do these studies, there's a very personal thing at one end, which is these individual mothers, right? We knew nothing personally about them. And so we had the studies. We have all these tubes, and they're labeled, you know, X, Y, Z, or something like that. They're just completely anonymized. And so you get all these numbers, and we get these numbers, and then we give it back to Alyssa, whose job now is to put the two together and say what related to what. And so she called, and I just thought we would just get random stuff. I thought, how can we possibly expect to see something? Because I knew all the complicated ways that you could change telomere length, you know, in single-cell organisms. And so how could we possibly get anything from people? But I was really intrigued. And she called up and she said, oh, my goodness, you know, this thing is actually, it's
so
relating
to
telomere.
So the telomeres changed with stress.
And it was the telomerase that was, it was getting damped down, and the telomeres were getting more worn down with stress quantitatively across these scales of how bad it had been or how long it had been. And so that was what, that was a real
that
eureka.
That was eureka, yeah.
But that was eureka, just, you know, numbers, right? Very, very abstract thing, but it came together.
But you knew it mattered.
We knew there was a pattern there. There was something going on, right?
That's great. Right. So now I want to ask a question that's not a science question, but I think a lot of fun. So I think there's 195 scientists who have received the Nobel for medicine or physiology since 1901, 195. That's rarefied air, 10 women. So what was it like for the phone to ring at home? And you pick up the phone and someone says, you've won the Nobel Prize in medicine or physiology. What was that like? How did it feel?
Well, what?
Why not? That's what Oprah would ask you.
Come on,
give us the inside scoop on what it was like when they called.
Well, it was this. It had two parts to it, because part of it was, it was very wonderful when I sort of realized, because it was 2 a.m.
It was, you know, 2 a.m.
It was 2 a.m. There's a big time difference, and so it was really bad. But the other thing was that we'd been at a reunion with my mother-in-law, family reunion. She's 95, and it was a birthday family reunion for her. And so my first thought was, oh my gosh, something's happened. We've just made, you know, overwhelmed her, and something's
bad. It was too much.
It was too much. And so, you know, there was this relief that sort of washed over me, because I sort of thought, you know, 2 a.m. has got to be bad.
2 a.m. phone calls are not usually good. Yes.
No. Yeah. And then of course, then this wonderful news. And so the person who you know, I've talked with subsequently, he's a very nice man, and he's the chair of the committee. So he said, you know, I'm calling, and told me what it was, and I was very happy, but sort of, because, you know, I've heard of people calling up their friends, and you know, who I presume don't remain their friends afterwards.
It would be a somewhat mean practical joke. Yeah.
Yes, right. So I sort of believed it, but I you know. I must have sounded incredulous, and he said, if you go on the website, you know, an hour from now, you could check it out. And he said, but he said, there's going to be a lot of press, you know, calling you quickly. He said, I'd advise you to have a cup of coffee.
So was that good advice?
It was superb advice, because I don't think I sat down for a meal for about 5 or 6 days.
Five or six days.
I mean, I was just on the run. I mean, eat, but it was
but
there was
you didn't sit. Wow.
Yes. Wow. So it was a very wonderful moment, but it was followed by a very exhausting five or 6 days.
So one of the wonderful things about winning the Nobel Prize is there's a ceremony with the king and queen in Stockholm, and I had the pleasure as chancellor of UCSF to travel to Stockholm and see Liz and her colleagues win the Nobel Prize. An unbelievable, actually a whole week of events and celebration that went along with the Nobel. There's royalty, there are crowns, there are gowns, there are speeches, there's a concert and wonderful lectures at the Karolinska. So what was the highlight of the week for you, Liz? What was it like, first of all, to be One of the great moments was seeing outside of the hotel Liz being asked for her autograph by young children in Stockholm, and this rock star sense and all of the pomp and circumstance. But what was the best moment and what was the worst moment of the week in Stockholm winning the Nobel Prize?
Well, there was a slightly anxious moment when the autograph hunters and a little fight broke out. and so I was with a whole lot of my family members. And so my brother, who's fairly burly, just sort of, you know, sort of gently
led me. He ran interference for you?
He led me in. But then he said the security staff outside the hotel were all getting their walkie-talkies out as they went in. So that was sort of a slightly strange moment because, you know, there was this slight altercation beginning with people, and I didn't understand why they were.
Now, if I remember right, there was a wonderful poster to talk about the Nobel Prize ceremonies, and they wanted you to sign the poster. Is that the way that it worked, or they had you sign anything?
At that stage, I think it was anything.
Anything,
yes,
pieces
yes,
of paper.
Yes. People were on a cold street, and I don't think they had big posters. yes. And the best moment.
The best moment.
That's really hard because it was so many wonderful moments. A lot of my family came, mm-hmm. and so we were having a very joyous kind of reunion as well. You've got me there. There were many wonderful moments. I had a nice talk with the king about wolves. So actually, that was kind of fun.
So during,
and that was unexpectedly fun. I would say perhaps
it was good. Now there's a fancy dinner that goes along with this, and you were seated next to the king, right?
A couple of them, yes. So okay. One of them I sat next to somebody different, and one of them I sat next.
That was when you spoke about wolves?
That was, I think, on yet another occasion. Right.
So a lot of wining and dining along with the Nobel Prize.
I think it was wonderful because the Swedish take it very seriously, and they were sort of very excited and happy that the three of us, I'll actually give you a highlight, because Jack Szostek and I and Carol Greider, we shared this prize, and we'd all worked together at different stages, although not all at once together. Carol and I had been separately, and Jack and I had been separately. But we really enjoyed each other's company, and I think that was actually a lovely thing, because it was telling people something about science that I could see they were picking up on, mm-hmm. the fact mm-hmm. that we had really, you know, taken great pleasure in the fact we had all had this wonderful recognition, and we had enjoyed working with each other. You know, we stopped just because we, you know, moved into different things in different places, but I think that was actually lovely too. We were sort of having a reunion too.
A science reunion of colleagues.
Yes. Yeah, and we were sending a message that science, even though that wasn't, you know, conscious or anything, it was true. And so that I think I liked, because people clearly were enjoying that.
That's great. Now I'm going to ask one more question, and then I'm going to open up the audience for questions. But it's a two-part question. One is now it's nearly a year, short of a year, probably around 9 months since the first announcement of it. How has your life changed since when, you know, people introduce you? I can imagine going to give a science talk and suddenly you're introduced as Nobel laureate Elizabeth Blackburn. A little more pressure that you have to give a good talk, or maybe your life has changed and different. Do you get reservations at restaurants easier? So one is, how has life changed for you? And what are your science ambitions now? How do you think about the future of what you want to accomplish in science? Because it seems minimally like an inflection point in how you might think about what you want to achieve in science. So has that changed or not changed at all?
It has in some way. There's a great constancy to it, but in another way, there's this feeling that I could be bolder about certain kinds of things that perhaps I was more reticent about doing, in terms of interesting collaborative things that I mightn't have done before, but which now I think would just be easier to jumpstart. And you know, like all science, it's going to have to stand on its merits. But that kind of thing has, it has sort of made me think somewhat more broadly about the things that I might embark upon.
That's great.
And things like that have, it's been happening. restaurants. Haven't tried that one. Actually, but my husband does it. He's great. He sometimes says, she's a Nobel laureate, and I don't really want to say that, but he says it. And so,
I was thinking restaurants and parking tickets, but I don't want you to quote me on that.
No. Right. Not the only reason I like traveling with him, but he does mention it, and I don't. And and people seem to be interested in the world about that. You know, in science, I think we take them more in our stride, yeah. I think, among scientists. And so things change somewhat, but not as much as they change for when I interact with people.
Outside of science.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So my dry cleaning person in our local neighborhood, you know, she was really, really thrilled about this. and I was glad that she was thrilled because it was good. It said, you know, this sort of thing means something to people.
That's great. So do you think it's...
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to A Life in Science with 2009 Nobel laureate Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn and UCSF Chancellor Susan Desmond-Hellman. So we'd like to open the floor to Q&A sessions, and if you have any questions, please raise your hand and wait until you have the microphone since we're recording this session. Any questions?
There's two in the front row and one back here.
So,
yes.
I would like to know...
Oh, excuse me.
She's giving the mic back there. Hold on 1 second.
Thank you. Forgive this very elementary question. But I became aware in, I think it was the mid-60s, that botany and biology had undergone a change, where I thought biology was the study of animals.
Yes, yes.
And botany was the study of plant forms.
I think many people did think
and
that way.
And as I went to higher education, no, it was all about cells.
Right.
Suddenly, life became a matter of substructure.
Yes.
And of cells,
yes,
rather
yes.
than the creatures that got you into your mm-hmm, science mm-hmm. and perhaps speak to all of us emotionally, all of a sudden they drop down to this mm-hmm. basement yes. level of inquiry. Am I right in thinking, did that happen in the 60s? Or
yes,
what
yes. I think people. Yes, I think that's a wonderful question because it really relates to how biology and the research has been evolving because, as you said, we saw the forms of animals and plants, and they look very different, and then started understanding how very unified they are. Plants, by the way, have the same chromosomes, the same telomeres, the same telomerase. Take away their telomerase, they can't keep replenishing themselves as plants. So all the same rules apply. But what's now becoming more and more fascinating, I think, as everybody in the fields of research has sort of seen, is... we know a huge amount about the molecular underpinnings and the building blocks at the molecular level of cells and cells building up bodies of animals and plants. And it's sort of come back to this, now we're trying to understand how it all works together to make the complex organism. So it's really interesting. They've sort of... it's full cycle, but now it's very informed by this tremendous... understanding of the sort of universality of the cellular mechanisms, and yet they play out and make totally different looking organisms, plants, animals, and so on. And so the fascination is now, how does this immensely complex thing, us, you know, all, you know, put together the cellular things? So I love the intellectual puzzle of, we're taking something at the level of cells, we're quantifying it, how well are the telomeres maintained? And we're asking questions now with our clinical colleagues and our psychology colleagues, how does the whole organism relate to this, which is the person? And this is a complex thing. You could call it a phenotype, if you will. That's what you call it in genetics. You know, what's the organism look like, right? And how does it work?
Am I correct that this started in the 60s, or was it before when... biology and botany became cellular rather than creature.
I think the 60s is good because some of the molecular tools started to get more and more really, really sort of exponentially understood. Yeah, 60s
yeah,
is
60s
reasonable.
And 70s, I think you would go into cell biology rather than botany or biology.
Right,
yeah?
Right. Yeah. Even though you might have tried.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes. Next question. Please raise your hand. Did you have your hands up? Okay.
Yes, they did.
I'm interested in your view of to what extent telomeres can regenerate, because I thought the problem with Dolly the sheep and cloning was that you died young because you had middle-aged telomeres.
Yeah. You see, it's a bit complicated because Dolly was one organism, and it was true that telomeres looked shorter in Dolly than in this, you know, than so it could have been true. But actually, people have cloned other livestock like calves, and the telomeres are actually longer. So if you have telomerase that's building it back, so if you have wearing down and then telomerase building it back, it's now dynamic, right? Sometimes more wearing down, sometimes more building back up. And that's what we're seeing is a better description for what's going on, that it's not inexorably wearing down. People thought in the days of Dolly that that might be what's going on and sort of gained a bit of a popular hold, but there really wasn't enough data at that point to generalize or even to say that that was the problem with Dolly. But we do think this wearing down is related to, you know, the ability to not stave off some of the diseases of old age. So there might have been a germ of truth in it, but I don't think we'll ever know with Dolly because there was only one.
Just a lay response as well. To a layperson, a mind-body connection, as you've described, somehow comes through either the steroid hormones or through adrenaline.
Yes.
I honestly don't know this research at all, but are either one of these substances
implicated? We're looking, exactly. Because, you see, the brain talks to your body by sending all sorts of both chemical and nervous signals to your body. And so that's a very rational way that it could be happening, right? That the clearly the chronic stress is being mediated through the brain. And the brain is very much part of our bodies and has tremendous effects on our physiology. You know, witness when you feel nervous and your heart beats and your stomach churns. I mean, that's your brain telling the rest of your body
what to do. And one quick one. Would you have come to science had you gone to Oxford instead of Cambridge?
Are you going to answer that question?
I was hooked. I was hooked when I was an undergraduate in Australia. I did my undergraduate work in Australia, a big state university, kind of like Berkeley, you know, very large place where you had to somewhat sink or swim a bit because it was very, very big. But I was pretty much hooked. So they couldn't have kept me away.
I had two questions. I wondered if, now that we have some ancient DNA preserved, is there any way that the telomere effect of DNA can be seen in ancient DNA like the Neanderthal? Because now you're talking about stress and whether modern days we have any more stress.
What a great question. It hasn't been asked. The answer is going to be extremely technical, which would be, will the preservation be good enough? It turns out that, you know, for reasons that are very technical and chemical, the telomeric DNA does seem to be rather more susceptible just to chemical breakdown even than, you know, the rest of the DNA. So it might be hard to do. But on the other hand, look at what people have done already with DNA samples that are quite old that they thought would be hopeless.
Okay.
So the question is going to be how you're going to pose the question. You know, you're going to have lots of Neanderthal samples or something, because what is one going to compare it with? So that's going to be an interesting thing to...
And then I have a second question. If you could comment on epigenetics at all?
Well, epigenetics is...
Just general...
Everything that's not genes. And so I think if we say epigenetics is everything that isn't our directly inherited DNA sequence, you know, complement of genes, then something like life effects like chronic psychological stress, the one that we can study, for example, that's certainly epigenetic. Now, there's another meaning of epigenetic that you might be meaning, and that is to say sometimes people use epigenetics and they mean changes of things on the chromosomes that are not exactly the genes themselves, but are proteins on the chromosomes that influence how the genes play out. And so telomeres certainly have their stories of epigenetic involvement, just as other parts of the chromosomes do. too much for tonight, but yes, we certainly think about it. And in a way, you can think about telomeres, their shortening and their lengthening. In a way, that's a sort of epigenetics. It's not the inherited sequences, something that can change and is on the chromosomes. So it's a sort of subset of the epigenetic phenomena. I don't want to get too technical. Sorry.
I have a somewhat personal question, and I hope you don't mind. My book club recently read Catherine Brady's book on you, and the most provocative quote that came out of it was this line that basically quoted you to say, at some point I finally had succeeded enough to have a child.
Did I say that?
Yeah, it was.
No. Everything written in this book was very, very accurate. So I'm sure I did, but it didn't really happen that way.
Mm-hmm. But it incited a lot of discussion.
But
you're
sounding like I'm a very rational person who said, "Okay, now I'm successful enough to have a child," but it actually didn't happen that way. It just happened, so to speak.
That's good to hear because that's how it happened to me too. But
great.
But that question of whether science is becoming more supportive to women as things have gone along.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point because I think. One did feel at the time when our son was born, which was in the 80s, that if you had a family and you were a woman, you were not going to be taken as seriously as a scientist. And somehow, you know, you'd sort of, if you will, you know, shown that you really weren't that serious a scientist. I mean, it's a silly perception when you think about it, but I think it was there and sort of a fear in the minds of young women a lot. I think it's much better now. I think people really, really are just not, you know, they're past that, I'm happy to say. And you know, it's been hard in some ways to get over that stereotype. One of the ways, for example, the American Society for Cell Biology just did a wonderful thing. This was for young scientists, but they just published photographs of all the women scientists who have children and with their families and just, you know, pictures tell 1,000 words, and they just published all the photographs and said, you know, you can look, right? So I think it's important to keep making sure that, you know, things don't slide into this perception. It's not that it's not difficult to both have a child and do science, because yes, it's extremely demanding, but I do like to point out too that if you want balance, you can achieve it sort of over a lifetime and not just every day be 50-50, you know, but sort of there'll be more or less intense times for science and more or less intense times for children. So before and after our son was growing up, that's very different from the sort of intensity as when our son was growing up. And then, you know, there were some extremely intense times for both or one would have to alternate with the other. So I think... can balance this out over a lifetime. And that's a concept that people sort of hear and they think, yeah, that makes sense. But it wasn't something people often think about when they're thinking about starting a family and feel very overwhelmed with, oh gosh, how can I possibly have a family and do science and keep up with the professional demands? It just often seems, you know, very, very impossible to young women. And so I think things are getting better, but it's helpful to think about a balance. People do want balance in their lives. But as I said, I think it's helpful to think about it as perhaps extending over, you know, much longer periods than averaging out every day, you know.
You spoke about stress reducing telomerase levels. I'm wondering if there are theories or if there is research about what generates telomerase levels.
Yes. It's a very complex set of biological inputs that determine the level of telomerase activity. So complex that you could almost pick any out of a hat and find one. And so really what it comes to is what are the quantitatively important ones, the ones that are rate-limiting. So there's plenty of data about various influences, and we're still sorting out which are the quantitatively important ones that are the ones that are having these long-term effects that we're seeing over, you know, some years in people's lives. There's lots of molecular detail known, actually, but how it all fits together into the what's the bottom line is definitely something we have to figure out.
Hi. Hearing about the damage to telomeres gets me thinking about, are there ways to repair that damage, in particularly among people who are chronically stressed?
We're doing studies. We published with Dean Ornish a pilot study a couple of years ago in which there's an intervention that was done initially for cardiovascular disease and very sort of intensive, changing a lot of things in their lives, like how they eat, how people eat and exercise and have social support and do stress reduction. So they do a lot of this, but they adhere well to it because people find they feel good doing it. So they adhere well to it. So we looked at what happens to their telomere maintenance machinery with people who did this, and we looked before and after, and we could see improvements. But we're trying to do this study now much more extensively. There are other hints, again, in very small studies that do imply that you can reverse the wearing down. Because once you have telomerase, which of course we have to various degrees, all it takes is the balance to shift in the other direction, right? The balance to shift away from the shortening trend to having, if you shift the balance with a little bit more telomerase, to shift it towards the lengthening trend, then that we're finding is correlating with things like less mortality from cardiovascular disease, for example. If your telomeres grow in a couple of years, you have three times less chance of dying, it turned out in one study, than those whose people had telomeres shortening in a couple of years. This was an elderly group of people being studied. So the answer is looking like, yes, lengthening and shortening are both possible in humans, and so it's a matter of how the balance plays out. And so can you manipulate it? There's no pharmaceutical or pill or anything known that could do this, and, you know, any such intervention would have to be done with great care and development. You know, if you wanted to, you know, pop a magic pill and make your telomeres longer, you wouldn't do that lightly for all sorts of reasons. But on the other hand, if you can do some sort of intervention that you're going to want to do anyway, you know, an exercise does mitigate the effects of stress on telomere shortening. We also found in a recent study, you know, who's to argue with exercise, right? So the question is, you know, do people want to do it? And can they do it in a way that's helpful? So that's the direction that at the moment we're taking, not to rule out any sort of eventual pharmaceutical intervention, perhaps, but right now there's nothing scientifically validated that pills or anything.
Next question.
If you could give one piece of advice to young scientists today, what would it be?
Well, you know, you always hear things like follow your passion and things like that, and I'll just take that for granted because that is, of course, very, very good advice. But this is what I'd say. I'd say, so it's a very competitive world in science. At least I'll talk about the kind I'm familiar with, which is biological science, and it's very competitive. And so you want to say, well, how am I going to do well? So what I would do is I would really stop and think, okay, what is a question, you know, that I have good training and expertise to really contribute to? What are some important questions that haven't been asked? You'd be amazed at how many questions in biology haven't been asked. We tend to sort of go with the flow and ask the same questions, but people who stop and really think about questions that haven't been asked, and then, you know, you want some expertise to be able to do it, right? I would really say, think of the really interesting questions. I review grants from people from certain agencies who encourage really interesting, out-of-the-box idea science by very qualified expertise people, not just people, you know, doing random stuff. And the interesting ideas that people come up with just makes you realize how many unanswered questions there are. So that's what I would do. Really think of interesting questions, because believe me, most questions haven't really been addressed. it's surprising. You think we know everything. Actually, in some ways, we know so little. So think boldly but use your expertise too. Right? I sort of did that. I had expertise, and I went after something. Nobody was going after the ends of chromosomes because I had some real technical expertise. I knew how to do very early versions of DNA sequencing, which now is old hat, but then was crucial.
Is there any reason to believe that telomeres shorten or lengthen at different rates in different kinds of cells?
Yes, every reason. But so the big picture is that there's reasonable sort of correlation among different cells in a certain person's body. But, okay, so that general picture is true. Now if we drill down, for example, we look at different kinds of white blood cells, the immune system cells. And we've studied this quite extensively, and others have too. But we know that the different subtypes definitely have different amounts of telomerase, different telomere lengths, and so forth. Different kinds of blood cells do. But as a group within a person, they'll sort of tend to track up and down. So there must be something fairly systemic that has some influence, and then individual cell types do have their own influences as well. So we're just learning all of this by observing in people, because there was no reason per se to say one way or the other. And yet everyone just assumed everybody's telomeres just wore down. You know, it was like, well, wait a minute, telomerase is there. Maybe they can be building up as well. And so it's back to your question, actually. Well, don't make too many assumptions. What do we really know, and what do we just, you know, receive as some idea, and then we just accept the idea and don't think about what was the basis for that statement that was made in innumerable reviews, right? And so...
Hi. Thanks for speaking.
Thanks for coming. Thank you for coming.
As a follow-up to the question about advice for young scientists, as you look in your crystal ball, how can we make sure we get enough resources to the young scientists to continue this work, and also what your thoughts were between the balance between applied research and basic research, and you know what should be the proper step to make sure that we continue this journey.
Yes. So I'm going to use an old saying that I heard somebody say. This is now, I'll work backwards, but the applied basic, you know, I heard a great saying once, which was there was no such thing as really applied and basic, it was more good and bad research, right? Meaning, don't think of it as being applied or otherwise, think about, is it good quality or not? Because I think it's a very mixed range of things. But I think I know the intent of your question, which is sometimes you could say, well, why are you doing things in working with little pond organisms that don't look as if they have anything very useful? And that's called basic research. But we learned all these things about what we're starting to think is important in humans by looking at individual cells in these very simple kinds of systems. So I think that the answer partly is, yes, we do want to make sure that we encourage science of all kinds, and it's the quality that matters. And if it's somebody working in something obscure, but if they're thinking well and doing really original things, that's valuable, even in and of itself, I would say, but probably valuable because in some unexpected way it'll turn out to be useful. So I think that sort of ferment of intellectual activity, doing all kinds of science, is exciting. And doing, you know, applied science is very exciting, you know, and has great intellectual challenges too. But I think, you know, they'll be gravitating to different areas. Now, how do we ensure that we have resources for that? So those, I think, become questions of, you know, national and state and educational policy, and that is to say, well, if there's a value in this, then it's important to put resources into it because, you know, and perhaps we can put the resources in more thoughtfully. I think, you know, I think we should not just say, oh, well, we can give up on, you know, putting resources into science, you know, done enough or something like that. That, I think, would be very counterproductive. But I think just as we think about, you know, all other kinds of resources, we should be thinking very carefully, what is the best way to put money in, what, by money, resources, I'm assuming you mean partly money. Yeah, we should think about how things are being done, You know, all around the world, budgets are getting very tight. It's probably a good time to just think about, have we done things, in the best possible way? I think that's, that's a scientist in me. You're always asking questions, right? And so I think we should ask questions. And I'm not criticizing necessarily. I think science support has been terrific in the US, and the resources that have gone in have truly paid off, I think. But we can always stop and think, are we doing it the best way? And, change course in certain ways if we want to. I'm not proposing anything specific here. I'm just saying, in principle, we should always be very, sort of make it a very lively ongoing process.
We have time for last question, I think. We have to close up. So.
So my question is, have you ever felt excluded in labs and universities from some kind of boys club type of thing? And have you found a useful way to try and balance it out for yourself?
Yes, I think that I definitely have sensed that. Not so much in the scientific arena, but perhaps in the more sort of, as we're dealing with, more sort of administrative, sort of things to do with the university. And I think maybe our chancellor should address this much more because, before she was chancellor, by the way, but I think that is a reality, and I freely feel that I admit that I've felt that way sometimes. Yeah. But how have I coped with it? I don't know if I've coped with it all that well. So I think we should ask our chancellor to give us good advice on this.
And I think also I'd like to know, this chancellor has crossed the line between, you used to be the president of product development at Genentech, and you now moved to the academia. So I guess I'd like to know what are the challenges there, and also I'd like you to address the previous question concerning women trying to advance in science field.
Well, I do think I agree with Liz that I think happily things are changing, but I also experienced in many ways, some big and some small, in a life in science and medicine, the most common challenge that I've had is being with a group of colleagues, all of whom are male, and the expectation being that I am the secretary or I'm, carrying the binder or something like that rather than the presenter. And my most effective tool for that has been humor. And particularly with patients. So one of my favorite stories was being at the San Francisco VA, and I was a second-year doctor, and I was working with a first-year doctor, and one of the patients persisted in calling me baby. And so I told the patient that that was Dr. Baby. and I've always tried to use humor. And when there's so few women and someone's expectation is that their doctor or the scientist will be a man, I've always tried to say, gee, that's when everyone looks alike, people's expectations are that everyone will look alike. But the good news is that at UCSF this year, in our incoming professional student class, 67% will be women. So that's medical, pharmacy, dental, and nursing school, 67% women. So now we have a shift of gender. And I think things will change. I'm amazed at UCSF how often students say to me how helpful it is to them to see a woman chancellor. And I do think that's the other challenge, is not to have any role models that aren't men. It's very challenging for women. But like I say, I think that is changing. It's changing from the bottom-up, so to speak, in terms of there's more students and trainees than there are full professors or tenured professors who are women. But we're seeing, I mean, seeing people like Liz for our students is amazing and wonderful. Regarding industry, I would say what Liz just said about basic and applied science, you know, there's really talented people in industry and in academia. And people often ask me, gee, when you went to industry, like the dark side, did you have to work really hard to keep your principles and your integrity? I've known people with great integrity in academia and in industry, and I've known people with poor integrity in academia and in industry. So it's the quality of the person, their values, their passion. What I find remarkable and similar in at Genentech and at UCSF is incredibly talented people working on a mission I care about a lot. And that's, for me, the best thing about both jobs. The biggest challenge we have at UCSF, of course, is the state budget and all of what that means for education. And so I like the question about science. And I've tried to push people to understand what a positive it is for business and our economy to have higher ed and to have institutions like UCSF. I mean, the job creation and the economic positive impact. We just did a study that showed in the last 8 years, the economic impact of UCSF alone, not the whole UC system, but UCSF alone in the Bay Area moved from $1.8 billion to $6.2 billion and almost 39,000 jobs in the Bay Area. I mean, that's the impact of one institution of higher education. So it's not just life-changing research like what Liz just described. It's jobs. It's good jobs, high-paying jobs. So I saw that impact at Genentech, where they kept R&D here in the local area. No outsourcing of R&D. It was here in the local Bay Area, specifically because of the quality of higher ed. So big change going from a biotech company to academia, but a very positive one.
Thank you so much, Dr. Blackburn and Chancellor Susan Desmond-Hellman.
Thank you. Thank you.
We also, our thanks to Dr. Blackburn and Chancellor Desmond-Hellman for their comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you so much.